Blog Talk Radio.
Delving past the headlines, sorting through the media bias, exposing the propaganda, and challenging you to use your brain. It's time to tap into the truth.
Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. It is indeed time to tap into the truth. Welcome to today's broadcast. Hope you're having a great day wherever you are and whatever it is you may be doing today. Wanted to start off today's broadcast with letting some folks locally know that thoughts and prayers are going out. Have two different groups of people in mind, two different families that have both lost loved ones in the past week, just the other day for one. It's always a tragedy when we lose somebody that's part of the family. And I just wanted to make sure that those folks, without calling them out by name, didn't want to embarrass anyone, but to let them know that I am thinking about them and praying for them and their families. And would last that you guys include them in unspoken prayers as well. I would greatly appreciate that. Also, on a personal note, my father once again has, this past week, had a series of medical issues that's had him both back in and out of the hospital, and he is back in again. So for those of you who are regulars to the show and who have sent prayers in the past, I would appreciate it if you would do so again. It means a lot, and prayer really does change things, and it means a lot to folks. Whether you realize it or not, it really does mean a lot. So with that having been said, well, let's kind of move on. I wanted to start off today's show talking about something I didn't get a chance to talk about last week. Just kind of ran out of time, wanted to touch on it. For about two and a half weeks previous to this week, one of the stories that had gotten a lot of traction along conservative media outlets was the story of LaToya Ammons. And she is an individual who was living in Gary, Indiana at the time that her story took place. And I had really wanted to get some in-depth conversation going on about it because Ms. Ammons claims that her children were possessed by demons while they were living in a rental house that they had. Now, what I found interesting about this story is that, first of all, this took place for several years before she was finally able to get her, her mother, and her three children out of the house. It was a gradual case, as often is, but just the sheer number of professionals and government workers that are now involved in this case, officially being on the record, having things to say that you wouldn't expect somebody officially to comment. It's just, it's shocking to me. And I think that's part of why this story has gotten as much attention as it has. Now, for those of you out there that don't believe in demons or demonic possession, well, then this is probably just an interesting side note to you. May not have any interest at all. And I don't shy away from religious topics, but I don't like the show to be overtly religious either because, you know, this isn't a religious show. It's a political show. But by the same time, I make no mistakes, and I'm certainly not apologetic about my faith, and I don't expect you to be either. So this does come down to an issue of faith. If you believe, then chances are you probably believe in evil forces as well. And in some cases, perhaps you do believe that these evil forces can inhabit and possess a person. Now, on the off chance that some of you may or not be familiar with the story, let me give you some backdrop here. And you can find a lot of this information at The Blaze, at The Daily Caller, at the Indy Star, which was who first put this story together, by the way, the Daily Mail. But Latoya Ammons was renting a home in Gary, Indiana. And over the course of time, odd things happened, you know, almost right off the bat. She was living there with her three children, two sons and a daughter, and her mother. She was active in her local church, and things basically occurred in a fashion where you could kind of blow them off, just strange coincidences, or maybe this happened and I just forgot I did this, or maybe I left that on, or maybe I didn't turn that off, or, well, you know, whatever. But things really started getting mega creepy on an evening when she had members of the church over and they heard her daughter screaming in her bedroom as she had went to bed for the evening. They ran up to go see what was wrong, and she was unconscious, but she was levitating over the bed, according to their accounts. So according to the accounts, they prayed over the girl for quite a while, the specifics somewhere between 15 to 20 minutes, and eventually she lowered back to the bed, and when she woke the next morning, had no memory of any of the events. Okay, so that's according to the story. Easy enough to still blow this off, right? Well, over the course of time, further signs of possession of the children took place. And as these things were manifesting themselves, it drew the attention of officials in school, and eventually their version of Health and Human Services intervened and opened up a case file, and they were investigating whether or not there was abuse going on in the home or if there was some type of mental illness being exhibited by one or more members of the household. One of the very shocking incidents that were reported, and this is where it really starts to get interesting, was they had taken the youngest boy to the emergency room or something. The caseworker was there, a nurse was there, and there were some other folks there as well, but according to the testimony of everyone in the room, and this was officially put in the file, the case file, that the state investigator put in her paperwork, said that just suddenly the boy flashed a uncanny, uncharacteristic grin, and then eased back to the wall and then walked backwards up the wall until he finally flipped over to the other side of, I believe it was the grandmother, if I'm remembering correctly from the story. And, you know, they didn't say he ran and did a gymnastic thing. He didn't do it, run forward towards the wall and did a backflip. He walked backwards up the wall. They specifically used the word walk. They've been questioned about that. And they have still concluded that it was a slow walk. This was not a normal, ordinary, humanly possible kind of thing. Now, again, still their testimony. But what stands out to me about that is that we are talking about a woman whose very job depends on her ability to be impartial, her ability to make determinations in the field, to see things for herself and make judgments over what these things mean. And she officially put that on her report. So it's in the record. She has since stood up and collaborated on behalf of the mother in question that odd things were going on. She officially put in her record that she believed the cause for the disruptions at home was, and I quote, the influence of evil forces. Now, I don't know how long this particular employee had been doing field work. I don't know if she's particularly gullible. Maybe she had some kind of agenda, but it seems odd that somebody whose very livelihood depends on her judgment in the field would be willing to do that. I mean, if that's me, I see something out of the ordinary, but I know my job's on the line, I maybe stand up for the mother on behalf of saying something along the lines that I don't believe there's anything that she's doing. But I don't believe for a second that I would put in an official report that I thought evil influences were behind it. You know, and that's just, again, fear of what other folks are going to think. And it's kind of funny because, you know, here on this show, I will come out and I'll tell you what I think. And I'm not concerned about what folks are going to think. I mean, I've put my name out here. I am Tim Tapp. You know who I am. You know where I'm at here in historic Roane County, Tennessee. You could track me down with that information if you were really so inclined. But I don't say anything here that I feel particularly that I need to hide from. There's nothing that I've said on this show that I wouldn't be willing to back up and discuss with you in person. But to put your livelihood on the line like that in a field where you're probably unemployed when you say and do something like this, that took real guts. And, you know, maybe she was so new to it she didn't know any better. I mean, I haven't been able to track down enough information about it, but that's the first place where this case really takes a turn for me that's worthwhile. And what I really would like to hear from you guys, if you've got similar stories or if you've got something interesting you'd like to discuss that goes along with this story, go ahead and give us a call in at 347-426-3550. Or you can hop in the chat room and you can make some comments in regards to this case or maybe an experience you've had that you'd like to share that falls in line with this. Because one of the really cool things about tapping into the truth is it's very versatile. You know, we focus on politics a lot, and we'll get to some politics a little bit later today, too. But truth, you know, you can be talking about just simple, basic, fundamental, this is fact, that is truth. Or you can be talking about the philosophical, what's true for you, what's true in your experience. I mean, some of these things, it's about delving a little bit further into finding out what is truth outside of our perceived realities. So, you know, I'd like to talk about this a little bit. I'd like to get your guys' input. So if anybody wants to call in, feel free. I gave the number already. You can hop in the chat room and comments that are relevant, we'll go ahead and throw out there too. I'd like to have an honest discussion. What do you guys think about this case? Now, where things pick up from there, I mean, that's the first thing that makes this case different to me. It's not just easily dismissed anymore. I mean, as much as it would be easily dismissed otherwise, if somebody just said, yeah, I saw my kid do this, you're like, okay, yeah, and I saw a Ouija board fly across a room one time. You know, it's just... it's just a story. Where's the verification? But people don't put this kind of thing into their official reports lightly. So that gets me interested. But then there's more to it than that. You know, once this story started getting out there again, and largely due in part to the Indy Star, then later The Blaze picked it up and started pushing it, and then it got picked up by a lot of other conservative outlets. And it was a bit of a sensation for better than 2.5 weeks just because it was outside of the norm of what you normally see and talk about on conservative news sites. And for a lot of folks, this is a verification of sorts in belief in higher powers. But what continues with this story? You have official police investigations taking place. While authorities were recording inside the home's basement, they reportedly picked up EVPs. You can clearly hear voices whispering. The word, hey, pops up several times, according to reports. And I've actually listened to one of the EVPs. I don't have that sound file available. I don't really want to waste a whole lot of time going into that if there's no interest in the story, but it strikes me as interesting because none of the officers were uttering anything while they were touring the home. You know, the police captain, Charles Austin, a 62-year-old, was so shaken up by the experience that he's speaking up. And he even said, and I quote, that that basement is a portal to hell. Every one of us who were there that day in the basements and who saw what we saw, went through what we went through, after we all think the same. We all call it the same. That bit of dirt is a portal to hell. They also took a picture, and I'm sure it's made its way over the internet, a picture from the outside of the house. And near one of the windows, there's a shadowy, but it's kind of it's a whitish, shadowy-looking figure. Now, it could just be a trick of light, but it is very humanesque looking from the picture. So you have the local police on the record making statements. They've had several city officials, as they were watching the house while they were conducting the investigations into the possibility of abuse going on, or then the possibility of someone else playing pranks on them, trying to convince them that their house was haunted. Not real sure why anybody would do that per se, but I've certainly heard of crueler pranks, especially by people that were angry or upset with folks. Bottom line is, there were cops that spent some time there. They got to where they would no longer stay on the premises while they were watching it. They stayed off the property boundaries altogether. Now, maybe this was just paranoia. You know, if you tell enough people the place is haunted and then they go in at night and suddenly every noise is something creepy. I mean, it could be as simple as that. But you don't normally expect to see police officers admit to such feelings. And you had folks, again, on the record. So there were so many folks on the record talking about this. The priest who administered both blessings on the house and multiple exorcisms on the children and the mother after they were able to move out of the house was actually a guest on the O'Reilly Factor. So he, again, recounted his tale of his involvement, getting to the house, feeling that there was definitely something amiss, something out of the ordinary. A clairvoyant who was called in before that to try and offer some type of assistance claims that the house was haunted by over 200 demons. And, you know, just things like that you can take with a grain of salt. But I still keep coming back to these official accounts and government documentation, places where ordinarily you don't see anything. I may have mentioned this before, but it reminds me, I'm a bit of a science geek. I haven't been following science, new science, as much as I would like to in recent days, because of my following of politics a bit closer for the purposes of doing this show. I'm a bit of a science geek, and therefore, by extension, I am also a bit of a science fiction geek, and I am a Trekkie. Not even a closet one. I mean, I don't go to Comic-Con, and I don't have a Starfleet uniform hanging in my closets. But I'm a Trekkie. I'm a fan of the show in all of its incarnations, and I enjoy the movies. And it brings to mind a scene in Star Trek IV, the fourth movie, where Kirk and company are landing the Klingon ship in a park. And some city workers who are doing garbage collection happen to be coming through the park about that time, and the ship lands, crushes a garbage can right in front of them, and then The one worker asked the guy driving the truck, "Did you see that?" And his response was, "No, and neither did you." And they left as fast as they could. Now, I tend to think that that's probably the reaction you get from most people that work for the government, because they don't want to endanger those jobs. So it just, it's very striking to me that this lady put that in her report. So, no comments. Nobody wants to call in and make a comment about it. All right, well, in case you're coming late to the show and catch this and would like to make a comment about this or another personal experience you may have had along a similar thing and make a statement regarding demonic possession or the like, then feel free to give us a call a little bit later. I will leave the phones open. I mean, but I want serious comments, please. Nobody call in just to say something snooty and hang up. I get enough of that as it is on the political side of things. I really want to encourage the discussion amongst you guys, the listeners, because I think it's an interesting conversation to have. But I also think that this story in particular is very interesting from the standpoint that lots of times you see websites and news organizations, when they come across these apparently real-life exorcism cases, you see them pop up around Halloween and when they're looking for something interesting. This wasn't done as a Halloween feature. This was done as a legitimate news piece for the area. And I have to tell you myself, in my family, there are a large number of preachers. Most of them have pastored or were pastored for the majority of their time. The denomination is Baptist, so please, those of you who are not Baptist, don't hold it against me. And for those of you who are Baptist, no, take it for what it's worth. I know that we don't particularly discuss exorcisms and possessions very often in the Baptist church. But one of the things that really stood out to me, one of the reasons why I believe that this is completely plausible as far as possession being within the realm of possibility, other than the fact that the biblical stories of Christ casting out demons, is the fact that my grandfather, James W. Tapp, for those of you who are local listeners, you'll probably be familiar with the name. He's been gone several years now, but one of the things that he did is he came across, well, he didn't come across it, but he had a recording of a possession and an exorcism that was carried out in Arkansas. It was a young girl. If I remember correctly, I believe she was preteen, but I don't remember what the age was. And all I heard was the recordings. And this recording was made by a personal friend of his who was sitting in on a exorcism attempt that was being performed by a friend of my grandfather's friend who was in a different denomination. He was setting in for verification purposes to make sure that things were being done safely and what have you. And the things I heard on that recording, and I wish I still had that recording, things I heard on that was enough to convince me. I mean, this girl changed languages midstream 3 or 4 times as she would respond to statements being made. And just the growls and the grunts and the noises that this girl was making during different points of the prayers that were going on during the course of this exorcism. There were times where, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that he completely trusted the guys that did this, but there would be no way that I would have believed that that was a human making those sounds. So that was pretty convincing to me in my youth. So I'm just curious. What do you guys think? What is your perspective on the possibility? Because I really think that that's the biggest reason why this story picked up the steam that it did. First of all, you had so many official people that are so reluctant to come forward and verify this type of information, this type of case, that are officially on the record. You have a great deal of emphasis on the fact that this woman was being investigated. People thought something was wrong in the house. People could clearly see it from the outside. And the first assumption is that there must be something wrong. It must be abuse. It must be mental illness. It must be any other excuse that we've come up with over the centuries to help put our mind at ease when it comes to facing the darkness that is true evil. Now, in my mind, there's no question. Evil is real. It exists. There are entities that serve the purpose of evil. It is hard to be a believer in God or in Christ and not believe in the enemy. Evil is real. But does it reach out? Do demonic forces try to destroy souls by possessing people? It's certainly rare, but doesn't happen for real. What's your thoughts? I'm going to close down the discussion here on my part of it, unless one of you guys want to call in and make statements about it. Again, that number is 347-426-3550. And I'll still take your calls if you'd like to discuss that. I'm going to go ahead and take a break here in just a minute, and then after that break, we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about this celebrity boxing match between George Zimmerman and DMZ. We will DMX. I'll say DMZ. We'll talk about that after the break. And if you guys want to talk about that, feel free to give me a call in regards to that, too. I will have the phone lines open. In the meanwhile, let's go ahead and take that break, shall we? We'll be right back right after this.
Into the truth. Listen in live every Sunday at 3 p.m. Check us out at tapintothetruth.com for our latest blog posts and for links to all of our past broadcasts. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. That's Tap Into the Truth every Sunday at 3 p.m.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Thanks for staying with us. Again, a quick reminder, if anybody wants to call in or comment or even just pop into the chat room and make a statement in regards to the story about the possessed family in Indiana, I will go ahead and take those calls throughout the show, so feel free. But we're going to go ahead and change gears a little bit. I'm going to talk about this celebrity boxing match that we have to look forward to. Now, in case you've been under a rock and haven't heard about this, evidently for a little while now, George Zimmerman has gotten it in his head that a way that he can try and capitalize on all the anger and hatred that people have towards him at the moment, and a way to try and make a little money and maybe stay famous a bit for a while longer, is to train to become a celebrity boxer. In the process, after he got so much training in, he decided that he was going to make an open challenge. Well, as it turned out, a particular fight promoter managed to get the rapper DMX to accept a boxing match. Now, it's been kind of a hot topic in certain corners, but again, in a lot of other areas, in a lot of mainstream, have hardly heard a peep. And maybe that's because they understand what I've been saying all along since I first heard about this, and that is, this doesn't serve any good purpose. Now, DMX has been on record at this point as making statements that he's going to mess up Zimmerman, he's going to get justice for Zimmerman. After he gets done beating the crap out of him, he's going to urinate on him publicly, that he's going to break every rule in boxing just so that he can beat the crap out of him. You know, all these statements that, you know, are designed to sound tough and appeal to DMX's audience, who are the hardcore, woe is me folks that, you know, believe that the only reason that they don't have anything is because everybody else is working against them. Now, that, I don't believe, represents a majority of any group of people, certainly not the majority of black Americans, but there are folks in each and every classification, every division of Americans that do have that attitude. Oh, everything is against me. I don't have anything because I can't get anywhere because everybody's fighting against me. Blah, 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 yakety smackety. It's not exclusive to one skin tone. I know a heck of a lot more white folks with that particular attitude than I do black folks. And I know quite a few of both, okay? So, be that as it may, there is a group of folks that this kind of thuggish reaction appeals to. And DMX is pointing to those folks. And I'm not saying that that's who DMX is, but I am saying that DMX is playing into that because that's who his producers tell him is his core audience. But this doesn't serve justice. Even if he beats the crap out of him, this is a lose-lose situation for DMX. It really is. Because on one hand, the folks that really want to see him go in there and hurt George Zimmerman, they're not going to be satisfied with whatever he ends up doing to him. No matter what it is, it's not going to be enough. He can kill the man in the ring, and it's not going to be enough. So those people aren't going to be satisfied. But what happens, heaven forbid, now, granted, I don't think it's particularly likely, if this boxing match does take place and it goes on as scheduled, what happens if George Zimmerman gets in a lucky shot? What happens if during his training he's actually gotten really, really good and he surprises you? I mean, George Zimmerman's not exactly a big guy. DMX, not exactly a small guy. DMX also in extremely good physical condition. Now, George Zimmerman, by the time this fight takes place and the fact that he's already been training, has plenty of time to get in really good physical condition and in fighting shape for a celebrity boxing match, at any rate. But what happens if he gets in a lucky shot? I mean, here in the South, we have the saying, every now and then, even a blind squirrel finds a nut. Point is that sometimes you can get a lucky shot in, and that's it. So what happens, heaven forbid, that DMX doesn't win that fight? DMX can't win. But worse than that, nobody can win. This is bad. This is bad politically. This is bad personally. This is bad for race relations. Because you can't possibly correct years of anger and race baiting that surround the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case with one celebrity boxing match, no matter what the outcome is. But worse than that, all you're really going to do is continue to help aid the race baiters in flaming the fire of separatism. Remember, there's a group of people in this country that operate politically that only get to do so because they keep us all separated into tiny little boxes, and we are so busy arguing with each other that we cannot come together and find solutions. There's a group of people in our political what's a good word for them? Aristocracy. That's a good word. There's a group of people operating within our political aristocracy that needs us focused on why we don't like each other so that we don't have time to focus on why they're not getting anything fixed that they easily could do. To keep us focused on why George Zimmerman should get beat up rather than focus on why we're letting somebody in D.C. push a policy to create a law that they know will not have the effect of helping Americans. See, if we start focusing on that, they're done. They're through. They need us distracted. They need you looking at the show rather than paying attention to the reality of what's going on. I've publicly called out already, please, DMX, don't do this. And anybody else, if DMX was to step out, anybody else that was thinking about stepping in, please, don't. Because it doesn't help anything. And in truth, this is not the reason why I think it's a bad idea, but this maybe might help convince those of you who would like to see him beat up. This helps George Zimmerman. There's a reason why this is his idea, people. He wants this fight. He made the open challenge. Why does he want it? He needs money. Now, I wish that George Zimmerman would have the ability to go back to a semi-normal life and to earn a living the way most reasonable people can and do. It's hard these days in the Obama economy. I understand that. And I'm certainly not throwing off on Zimmerman for his attempts at a creative solution. But this is a bad idea from start to finish. But if you're one of these people that wants a shot at Zimmerman, you think he should be punished. I promise you, nothing would punish him more than for everyone to ignore him. Nothing would punish him more than for there to be no buzz about this story, for nobody to be talking about it, and for nobody to want to watch it, because the promoter is the one who stands to make the most money. And the guy who's promoting this fight, by the way, got in trouble in Pennsylvania for fixing fights. So he's kind of hard up and desperate to try and make money surrounding the area of his chosen profession, by the way, which is promoting boxing. This guy's not exactly on the level, and he is an anti-Zimmerman guy to boot. Personally, I think it's time we moved on. We need to accept the fact that justice, whether you feel like it was served or not, justice was done. Our court system, as imperfect as it may be, worked the way it was supposed to work. The state had no case against Zimmerman. And unfortunately, that's the way it happens. And I ask you to put yourself in the position of being the accused. All you have is a media trying to show a public edited versions of proof. And then a lot of extrapolation, a lot of assumptions being made, and you only have your word as to what actually happened, and nobody else is there to testify against you. There are no eyewitnesses. Would you really want to be in a judicial system? Would you want to stand up in front of a court, in front of a judge, in front of a jury that would find you guilty despite the tremendous lack of evidence that you had done anything wrong? If you can honestly say, yes, I want to be in that country, then guess what? There's plenty of other countries around the world that it still works that way. You won't have a problem finding a place you'd be happy at. But that's not the way I want things to work here in the United States, and I hope that's not the way that you want things to work here in the United States. So the case is over. Trayvon Martin was not some innocent little kid. People need to move past that. The image portrayed in the media was not an accurate image or depiction of who and what Trayvon Martin was. Oh, he just went to get some tea and Skittles. We all know now that that's just another way to get high. It's part of a little game that's incorporated with the drug culture, of which we know Trayvon Martin was a part of. George Zimmerman, and I really don't want to go back into all of this. I really don't. If you want to make a statement, you want to call in, you want to say something about it, feel free. George Zimmerman was on Neighborhood Watch. Trayvon Martin was rarely in that area. George Zimmerman probably had never seen him before. It was raining, and Trayvon was walking underneath the eaves of houses to try and stay dry. Well, while you can understand that to a degree, in a neighborhood that had recently been robbed quite a bit, that's going to draw the attention of a neighborhood watch. Or at least it certainly should. If it doesn't, your neighborhood watch ain't worth jack. From the point where he called 911 to say, hey, I've got this guy going house to house, looks like he's looking in windows, that's suspicious activity. You can't paint that any other way. Now, is that enough to get killed over? No. Is it enough to draw the attention of a neighborhood watch and presumably the attention of the police under normal circumstances? Yeah, I would think so. Certainly it should be. Again, if it doesn't in your neighborhood, then your neighborhood's police and your neighborhood's neighborhood watch isn't working too well. But isn't that the way you would want your neighborhood watch to work? I mean, that is the purpose of a neighborhood watch. You're watching out for your place and your neighbor's places to try and help prevent crime. Technically, in your household, don't you want crime prevented? That means occasionally if you see somebody acting suspicious, you check it out. You don't wait till there's a crime. You prevent the crime. That's the idea. That doesn't mean anybody gets arrested. That doesn't mean anybody gets shot. That doesn't mean anything. So, yes, obviously at some point stupidity took over on at least one, possibly on the parts of both. But what it comes down to when this case was all said and done, it was George Zimmerman's word against other people who weren't there. Trayvon Martin was not there to tell his side of the story. But even the side of the story told by the girl that Trayvon had called and was talking to doesn't preclude Trayvon from guilt on the part of his activities. Just says that, hey, he's being followed, he's being watched, and he decided to cut back around and find out what the deal was. He's part of a street mentality that means you've got to stand and you've got to represent and you've got to do all that. And sadly, sometimes that leads to bad situations. People lose their cool. People lose their temper. Things get said. Things get physical. And when one of these people is armed, people get shot. Shouldn't have happened. It's a case that should have never escalated to that point. But at the end of this court case, there were no eyewitnesses that could stand and say what had happened. The only person that was there, saw it, was George Zimmerman. The only person that was still available to tell what had happened once it was done was George Zimmerman. That's why the police weren't going to pursue it. They knew they didn't have a case. That's why the DA wasn't initially going to pursue a case. They knew they didn't have enough to get a conviction. It would have been a waste of taxpayer dollars. Not that they didn't feel like maybe something had went awry. Not that they didn't think that there was still some culpability on the part of Mr. Zimmerman. But that has to be determined in a civil case, not in a criminal. It wasn't enough for a conviction. So we go beyond that, and we get back to this point. Who benefits from this fight? Only one person benefits from this celebrity boxing match, and that is George Zimmerman. Does George deserve the right to continue on with his life? Yes. But in my opinion, and that's all it is, so, you know, take it for what it's worth, and we'll be all happy. But in my opinion, now George Zimmerman is stepping across the line and trying to capitalize on the tragedy that was this shooting. And whether you're part of the hardcore camp that thinks that Trayvon Martin was just a street thug and him being shot wasn't a tragedy, then you still have to admit that it's a tragedy that George Zimmerman's never going to have his life back. And he's not. He's never going to have a normal life at this point. People will eventually forget, but it's going to take a long time. But you know what? It goes a lot faster if you don't do stupid stuff like, oh, I don't know, make an open challenge for a celebrity boxing match. This is a bad idea, George. So, you know what? And the worst part now is even though I'm wishing that common sense or some freaking decency would inject itself into this situation, that you have two very proud egos so that neither one's likely to back down. Because what happens? George Zimmerman now decides he's not going to do it. Then everybody says, oh, yeah, he was afraid of DMX. He knew he was going to get his butt beaten and blah, 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 yakety smackety. So, George Zimmerman will probably not back down or back out. I hope he does. But I also understand that George Zimmerman is desperate right now for a way to try and make money, or he wouldn't be doing this in the first place. This is a show of desperation. So that's why I initially, when I first started talking about this, appealed to DMX. And it's not like I expect he's going to hear this. I don't think I'm on DMX's listening list. You're not going to catch You're not going to catch my podcast on his iPad. I really doubt it. I mean, if you do, hey, great. That would be awesome. But I don't think it's likely. So under that particular situation, still, maybe somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who knows him eventually might say, hey, you know what? This guy made this really good point about how it would have hurt Zimmerman more if you just ignored him. Maybe that'll get across to him, and maybe he will. Or maybe just the whole point of how bad this continues to hurt race relations in America might be enough. And I don't know that it would be, but this will. This continues to further that divide. Aren't we divided enough, people? Come on. This is like the Jerry Springer show on steroids. It's appealing to the lowest common denominators among all of us. It's delving down to the animalistic ideology of we've got to avenge this. We have to avenge that. And there is darkness and evil in our hearts that we just have to let out occasionally. It's the whole theory behind the Purge. I'm assuming by now most of you guys have seen the movie The Purge. If you haven't, I recommend watching it. It has a lot of very strong social commentary. But the basic premise is that the new founding fathers of America decided to save the country by giving Americans one night a year to just go out and commit any crime they want to, including rape, murder, whatever. There was a 12-hour time period, or I think it was 12. It's been a while since I've watched the movie now, where there was no emergency services available and all crime was legal. There was nothing that could be done repercussion-wise for anything that happened within that time period. It's actually, if you get the full message, to me it seems like a very strong anti-eugenics message. You know, the eugenicists, the humanists, the transhumanists, whatever portion of the movement they happen to be in. You know, it deals with the issues of how that would only really affect poor people and how certain corporate entities made big money off of it by selling security systems and helping to make houses invasion-proof and, you know, that kind of issue. There was a lot of underlying themes that were very anti-eugenicist. So for that reason alone, I kind of liked the movie. A lot of people saw it, though, and you only see what they want to see. I heard some folks say that, yeah, this is about how those crazy conservatives just want to kill all the poor people, and that was all they took from the movie. So for that reason, on that level, folks are going to see a movie, they're going to take out of it what they want to take out of it. But what's really astounding to me is the fact that, you know, that the Man of Steel movie, also a fairly big movie recently, very strong anti-eugenics message. And that one wasn't even veiled, you know, about the cloning people to serve a specific purpose in society. Elysium, also recently, very strong anti-eugenicist message. So I'm almost surprised to a degree that Hollywood is accepting these roles, although the fact that they are able to paint these a little differently than just anti-eugenicists, it's good to see those messages out there. These people are the eugenicists. They're a dangerous lot of folks. So at any rate, it's a bad idea. It sets race relations back. Nothing good can or will come from that kind of behavior. This boxing match, it's a bad idea. So everybody involved, please take a step back, think about this, and let's not do this, shall we? So at any rate, if any of you guys would like to call in and comment, add to it, or hop in the chat room and make a comment that's pertinent to that topic, feel free. Worthwhile comments, I'll go ahead and read on air in the meanwhile. You know, I find it very disappointing that our society has come to this, that a celebrity boxing match between George Zimmerman and anybody be something anyone would want to see. I mean, I understand the eye for an eye mentality. I do. I get it. But you have to stop and think about who is better served by this activity. The only person who comes out of this with a win, no matter how the fight ends up, is George Zimmerman, because he gets some money. He's having a hard time getting money in other fashions. I would like for him to be able to make a living some other way. And yeah, I've already said that, but there it is. That's the end of it. I think that we need to move past the George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin case. I don't think we do that by hanging on to that animosity and wanting to see any rapper, whether it's DMX or anyone else, get into a boxing ring and have him threaten to break all the rules and do whatever else he's planning on doing, even if that's just for show. I hope that the bottom drops out of this idea, or somebody steps in to stop it. Something. Common sense needs to prevail. This is not a good idea. So there you go. If you want to call in, say something about it, the number is 347-426-3550. Or if you're listening to the show live, you can pop into the chat room and we'll have a discussion. If you want to chat that way, that's fine too. But in the meanwhile, we're closing in on the hour mark, so we'll take another break. And after that, we'll switch gears again. And we'll talk a little bit about CVS and their decision to stop selling tobacco products. I just think that's kind of an interesting move. And we'll talk about it for a little bit. In the meanwhile, that number's the same if you want to call in and comment about that. And still taking calls from the first segment, too, if you want to talk about the Gary, Indiana possession case. And in this case, it's a case of demonic possession, not simple possession, for those of you who might have tuned in late. At any rate, we'll be back in just a bit. So stay with us.
Never realized.
Tap Into the Truth. Listen in live every Sunday at 3 p.m. Check us out at tapintothetruth.com for our latest blog posts and for links to all of our past broadcasts. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. That's Tap Into the Truth every Sunday at 3 p.m.
Thanks for staying with us. And just like the little promo says, we do get started here at Blog Talk every Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. The show runs for 2 hours, at least for the time being. We might be expanding it in the future, or who knows, we may cut it back if the ratings take a dip in the other direction. But at any rate, hopefully that won't happen. I wanted to go ahead and talk a little bit about CVS. A lot of people talk about how corporate America is all about profits, and they ignore conscience. And I've never believed that to be the case in all cases. I know in a lot of cases you see where that may very well be the case. But CVS, being a pharmacy, thereby being a company that you want to trust to help you with your health, they've made a decision that they are no longer going to sell tobacco products. And this basically coming down to a business's freedom to choose how they're going to run their business drives the point home that corporate greed is not the only thing in play. Now, ordinarily, when you see an example of a company ignoring corporate greed, it's normally among, am I saying the word normally too much? It's ordinarily among faith-based companies, companies that are run by strongly religious folks that refuse to compromise their faith through the purposes of just to make a buck. Sometimes you see companies that fail to follow that principle, but then you see companies like, oh, say, Chick-fil-A, for example. Unfortunately for me, the days that I most want a Chick-fil-A sandwich is usually Sunday after church. Well, guess what? Chick-fil-A isn't open on Sundays. They, because of their Christian belief, believe that Sundays should be kept sacred and you should be able to have a day of rest and spend time with your families. They hold to that principle. Do you have any idea how many billions of dollars a year Chick-fil-A misses out on just because they're not open on Sunday? It would be difficult to calculate it without a thorough understanding of what their normal daily business is and then compare it to other similar businesses that sell a similar product. But it's easy enough to see that it nationwide could cost them $1 million a weekend. Maybe more. But that doesn't matter. They made the decision, and they've held to it. But now CVS has decided that they're going to turn down, voluntarily give up, what equates to roughly about $2 billion a year in sales. Apparently, the only reason that this is going to happen is because the leadership for the company has decided it's the right thing to do. In a comment made to USA Today, Helena Foulkes, CVS's president, said that, quote, "We really thought about this decision, and it relates to the future as a healthy company. It's good for customers and our company in the long run." Now, this may come as a shock to government planners who prefer to regulate the activities of businesses and consumers. Most recently, Obamacare's menu labeling requirements threatening to cripple some restaurant businesses. But despite the fact that the nutrition information is already available from the restaurants, usually online or on the menu, businesses want to provide products and services that customers want to buy, period. If they don't, they go out of business. But CVS's move to change the products it offers shows that plenty of business leaders consider more than just the bottom line. They consider the values they want their company to reflect. This is another freedom they should enjoy, at least here in the United States, though it has recently been denied to businesses like Hobby Lobby that are trying to defend their right to do business in accordance with their values. So will CVS be successful in this new direction? Not only time and, of course, customers will determine that, but it's the type of decision businesses should be free to make without interference from the government. This is one we are probably not going to see much in the way of interference from the government. Kind of falls in line with their desire to take smoking and other forms of tobacco use out of the mainstream. So they're probably okay with this. In fact, they may be getting some type of unofficial, currently unknown kickback from the government to do so. I hope not. And I don't mean to cast any dispersions over a situation that I know nothing about. Just throw that out there as a possibility, because lots of times businesses have a hard time dropping a product or product line that consumers definitely want when it equates to that much in sales. Estimated at roughly about $2 billion a year based on what they sell of tobacco products. So I stand up and applaud them. I mean, I feel like that's a freedom they should have. They should be able to pick and choose what they're going to carry in their stores. That's why they have buyers. That's why they have people who decide what brands they're going to have. So if you decide there's an entire industry that is no longer going to be represented in what you do, that should be your choice. And you should, in a free market, stand or fall based on those choices. I think CVS will be fine. I think that represents a very small portion of what CVS does on an annual basis. They are still primarily a pharmacy/convenience store. In a lot of ways, it is convenient. I mean, you've been inside the stores. You know what I'm talking about. In the non-pharmacy part of the store, you have a small version of a big box store. Just don't always have all the name brands of some items like toys and what have you. Usually smaller brands, we'll say, in an attempt to sound polite. They focus on a very limited range of items, but they are, in essence, an offspring of a convenience store and a big box store for everything outside of the pharmacy end of things. They have other reasons they want to bring you in. Why choose this pharmacy over that pharmacy when you can get the same drugs that I ever want? Well, because you can get stuff at ours that you can't get in theirs. Okay. Nothing wrong with that business model. So they've made this decision, and I'm curious to get the feedback from the audience so far. Not getting a whole lot in the way of feedback today, but if anybody has any comments to make, I'd be willing to take calls on it. The thing here, though, that's of most interest to me is that very few people have been talking about this. I've heard some folks talk about it a little bit, but I haven't heard much in the discussion, and most of what I have heard has been people criticizing CVS for making the move. I think it's a fantastic decision for them to stand on a principle. They don't feel that tobacco products are healthy, and they feel like their core business is health. They're trying to sell things that help you to be healthier. At least that's the business plan. That's the model. They don't feel like that particular item fits within their model. Okay? So there you go. I think it's a great example of what businesses can do on their own without government regulation, without prodding from a central planning department. They're willing to leave $2 billion a year in sales annually on the table for the virtue of following their beliefs. That, I think, is commendable. I think that that is a tremendous opportunity that businesses have here, that individuals have here, an attempt to stand on principle and let the people decide if they want to stand with you based on that decision or if they want to just go somewhere else because they still want that product. You know, that $2 billion a year annually is just sales of tobacco products. We're really talking about a lot more, because what happens to the folks that are smokers who are stopping in now because they know they can get the other stuff they need and their cigarettes or their chewing tobacco or their snuff or whatever, depending on where you're at, what you're getting. They know they can get it all there at the same time. Well, now they can't get that there. So they may go to another pharmacy and get all the other things they were going to get. There's no way of knowing exactly how much in sales they're going to lose there. There isn't, because some folks will stand by them anyway. They may pick up new sales. New people will go to CVS now to show support and appreciation of this decision. And that's great. That kind of freedom should be exercised, and it is, again, a tremendous example of what happens when you let businesses make their own decisions. Don't penalize Hobby Lobby because they want to run their company based on biblical principle. Don't force them into providing contraceptives. Don't penalize Chick-fil-A because their CEO says that they believe in the biblical definition of marriage. If you don't like what he says, then don't go back. You can get a chicken sandwich somewhere else. It may not be as good. And don't get me wrong, I'm a fan of KFC. But the KFC sandwiches, they're not as good as a Chick-fil-A sandwich. They're not. Now, you're not going to get a great bucket of original recipe chicken at Chick-fil-A. In truth, if you're trying to be healthier, though, you probably shouldn't do either. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. All right, so nobody in the chat room seems to be interested in this topic, and I'm not getting anybody on the switchboard. So I guess we will we'll move on from that topic. You know, I really just don't see any reason going on about it, taking up more time than need be. But I definitely felt like it was important enough to discuss, because that level of corporate freedom is where we should be. In a free market, the decision will be made. They will sink or swim based on their choices. And I think CVS will be fine from this. I certainly have no hopes that they'll fail from it. I do think that they will be fine. But I think it really makes a statement that big business is willing to put principle ahead of profits in a multitude of forms. And I think that's exactly what you're seeing here. So that's that, and we will move on. Yeah, one of the interesting things, a new topic I wanted to talk about, the whole voter ID stuff that keeps going on blows my mind that this is an issue. But here's something. I was going to save this for headlines you may have missed, but this one's too good to wait to that point. I will probably slip something else in that place. But see, the NAACP was organizing a march protesting North Carolina's voter ID law. The funny thing here, though, is that in order to march in this protest, they were requiring you to show your photo ID. They evidently didn't want just random people getting into this thing, so they wanted to make sure they knew who you were. Tell me that's not the definition of irony. North Carolinians marching to protest voter ID laws must present a valid photo ID to participate in an NAACP-hosted protest against voter ID laws in Raleigh that took place this past Saturday. The central claim among the protesters is that the voter ID law disenfranchises certain segments of the voting population, particularly minority voters and poor voters. Now, according to the official NAACP flyers passed out at the rally, protesters must carry the precise kind of ID that they would be expected to present at the voting booth. Important do's and don'ts for marchers. This march and rally will be conducted in a peaceful and nonviolent manner in accordance with the historic custom of the civil rights movement. As invitees, participants agreed to conduct themselves accordingly and to promptly obey instructions of the marshals at all times. Okay. That does seem like an important do, and I can appreciate that. Be respectful, be peaceful, conduct yourself in a nonviolent manner. Okay, good deal. Now, here's the official list of do's. Do, know your bus number, marshals and bus captains. Do, look out for the elderly and the young. Do, ignore any taunts and or jeers from the public. Do not react to such in any manner by starting or using verbal facial expressions. Okay. That's probably a little bit harder for some folks, understandably so, but I'm glad to see that this is what they're promoting. Do, observe proper decorum at all times, demonstrating respect for and following instructions from marshals and law enforcement. Okay, also good. Do, direct media inquiries to spokespersons. Remember, nothing is ever off the record. Okay, that's also very good advice. Do, watch for people who join the march from the public and notify a marshal. Okay. Do, immediately report any altercations, unruly behavior, or persons deviating from the rules to a marshal. Do, remain calm if any altercations or other disruptions occur. Do, bring photo identification, driver's license, passport, and or other valid photo ID with you to keep it on your person at all times. No explanation as to why. Now, all of those do's represent very important things. Okay, so that's good. Now, the march, which was dubbed the Moral March, not sure why he chose that, except the fact that the leader was the Reverend William Barber II, who called for a, quote, wave of civil disobedience while rallying against education cuts and the voter ID law, is the latest of a series of protests held against the state's GOP-controlled legislature. Over 900 peaceful and nonviolent protesters have been arrested since the beginning of the state legislative session last January. At the start of this year, a little more than a month, over 900 protesters have been arrested. And there's a reason why peaceful and nonviolent Should have been getting air quotes there. Police have taken a handful of them into custody each week after they obstructed legislatures within the Capitol building. Now, Barber also drew criticism in January for labeling South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, the first African-American to serve the state as a senator since 1881, a ventriloquist dummy. Said, quote, a ventriloquist can always find a good dummy. Now, that's just bad, because everything I've seen from Tim Scott, he seems like he's a decent conservative and a good guy. He seems pretty smart, and I don't think he's anyone's dummy. Of course, he's been called a lot worse than that by members of the black community who are more involved in separate behavior. Everything from an Uncle Tom to a house, well, you know the rest. It's not appropriate, and it's pretty inaccurate, too. Because, like I said, Tim Scott is nobody's dummy, and certainly not just a ventriloquist dummy for the right wing. But at any rate, I just find the irony of the story too much to ignore. They want you to have your voter, your personal ID handy, your photo ID, in case trouble breaks out. That's why they want you to have it. They want you to be able to be identified, and they want to make sure that you are who you say you are. So, yay, good for you. That's fantastic. But tell me, isn't that just a little bit, I don't know, no, it's not a little bit. It's very, very funny. It's very funny. And the reason why it's funny is because they're telling you one of the most important things they're trying to say to you is have your photo ID available in a protest that supposedly claims that having a photo ID is an unfair burden on the general public who might want to go vote. Does anybody else find that humorous? I mean, seriously, come on, guys. This is funny.
Yeah, we don't think you should have to have a photo ID to vote. But you better bring one with you here to the protest, you know, just in case.
It's just obnoxious, and it is ridiculous. And it is a few other things to boot. But the way this all plays out is the whole push against photo IDs, it's not about disenfranchising voters. It's about being able to verify you are who you say you are. It's no coincidence that in states that had photo ID laws in the last presidential election, that you did not see statistical anomalies like more people having voted than who were registered to vote in a district. In states that had photo ID laws, you did not see statistical anomalies like somebody getting 100% or more than 100% of the number of votes in comparison to the number of registered voters in a precinct. In states that had photo ID laws, you did not see Barack Hussein Obama win that state. Is that coincidence? The bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, is that if you don't have a photo ID, you're probably not registered to vote anyway. And if you're not registered to vote, you have no business voting. It's not terribly difficult to register. It's not. In fact, you can register by mail. I know this because right now I'm in the process of registering people to vote, a few people, during the process of campaigning. I have decided to run for county commission once again. I ran for it about 4 years ago. I'm running again. Or at least I'm hoping to run. I still don't have all my signatures yet. Got to get the signatures to get on the ballot. You know, blah, 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 yakety smackety. So there you go. Looking to do that. So I know I have a voter registration forms that the election commission gives to all the candidates so that they can get people registered to vote who are qualified to vote. Now, they do a little background check, make sure, okay, you're over 18 and you're not a convicted felon who's had your right to vote taken from you, or if you are a convicted felon but you haven't gotten your voting rights restored yet. In either case, it's not hard to register. The photo ID is just to demonstrate that you are, in fact, who you say you are. They want to match you up with a name that is on their sheet. That's it. What's the hardship? The government expects you to produce a photo ID to do anything with them, whether you're trying to apply for benefits or apply for, well, just about anything. Goodness gracious. So, I mean, it's hypocrisy in order. The people that are fighting photo ID laws in states, it's not about disenfranchisement. It's about, plain and simple, straight up, being able to get fraudulent votes in, because it's easy to register people to vote. If there wasn't a photo ID law in the state of Tennessee right now as a candidate, they give me more than enough registration forms that I could fill them all out with fictitious names, send them to different parts of the county, have it go to a friend's house or a neighbor's house or somebody's house that would then in turn send those cards back to me. And then I could go from precinct to precinct and district to district and vote as that person. I could, in fact, use those names, send them all out, to get enough fictitious names to put on my petition to qualify to get on there anyway. But if there weren't photo ID laws, then I could go and vote that many times, and they wouldn't have a way to stop it. I mean, even if you have a good group of folks running the polls, you had a card, and that's all you're required to show, then it matches up with the name on the list, then you get to go vote. And point of fact, you could probably do two, maybe even three different cards for each polling place. And when folks switched out, you can go in and vote as somebody else. So the photo ID law is designed to prevent that type of fraud because it's easy to do under the system. We want everybody who's eligible to vote to be able to go vote. But having a photo ID has not been deemed to be a general hardship on most Americans. You have to have one to open a bank account. You have to have one to apply for benefits. You have to have one to apply for most jobs. It's not a terrible burden. And it does seem to work in reducing the amount of voter fraud. So what is the problem against it? Now, I understand, again, we want you to be able to prove you are who you say you are when it comes to this, because they are concerned about people joining the march that weren't invited. And they should be, because what happens if you're somebody on the other side of the argument and you're not very nice? And they know this kind of thing because the folks on the left actually have been known to do this quite a bit. It's straight out of their playbook, quite honestly. Infiltrate one of their demonstrations like you're one of them and then cause trouble and make the group look bad. That's something they do. Something they do a lot. So there you go. Watch out for somebody that joins in the group. Inform a marshal or bus leader immediately.
Because they want to know immediately, hey, you're not actually supposed to be part of this, and we need to be able to see your photo ID. So anyway, the delicious irony of a protest against voter ID laws requiring you to bring a photo ID in order to participate. Tell me that's not just hilarious. All right. You know, we're closing in. A little surprised that nobody's called in wanting to talk about any of these subjects. I thought for sure the Zimmerman thing would draw a phone call at least. And nobody's called in today, though, so maybe everybody's still just trying to make up their mind how they feel about it. Because, you know, I'm sure there's some mixed feelings about that. I did get some pushback last week about the Bizzle response to Same Love in his rap. We played it for you last week and tried to address the issue. Now, nobody called in then, and nobody was involved in the chat room then in regards to the topic, which is surprising because ordinarily in the chat room, when we talk about anything controversial, we get some stuff going on. There was a conversation going on completely unrelated to show topics between a couple of folks, and, you know, and that's fine. I don't mind you guys. That's what a chat room's for. Talk, get on the subjects, deal with it, whatever. You know, I'm not complaining about that in any way, don't get me wrong. But no real mention. But I did get some pushback messages after the fact. Folks that caught it on podcast in particular sent me some messages via the website. And you can do that too if you like. You can go to tapintothetruth.com. And at the near the bottom of the homepage, you have a choice. You can send a message via the page. Or a little bit below that, there is a button where you go directly to email. Now, I probably would see the button via directly email, any messages you send there, a little bit sooner. So if that's how you prefer to, you're more than welcome to do that. And I welcome comments about the show and the topics. And excuse me. And if you have anything particularly noteworthy, I would be more than happy to bring that up on air on a later broadcast. I'm always happy to mention involvement and how people get involved with the show. And speaking on that particular topic, I'd like to welcome Emily Keller to the Tap Into the Truth Facebook family. She's one of our most recent likes. She liked the Facebook page for the show, so wanted to make sure I sent a shout out to her, let her know that you know, not only do I notice, but I appreciate this. I actually had slowed down a little bit in likes at the page. Got that core group of folks that are involved and are giving feedback and pushback and all that wonderful stuff. So I just want to make sure that everybody's aware that I do take the time to check the messages and we go over them and I see who the new likes are and I do look at the comments, and I'm willing to discuss them with you directly. I don't always have enough time to do it as quickly as I would like, so please forgive that. But, yeah, I mean, comments are welcome at all times. Pro, con, for, against, whether you think I'm a moron or whether you think I'm 100% right, and heaven help you if you think I'm 100% right, because we both got problems. But regardless of how that works out, you know, part of the lifeblood of any talk show is interaction. You know, I have a core audience. You always try to grow that audience. And you do that by reaching out to new people, utilizing social media, and seeing social media push back towards you. One of the things I also like to do with the show, too, especially at the Facebook page in particular, is I like to go sometimes to these parody sites and pull stories just to see if I get any pushback. Because, again, part of what I'm challenging you to do is to use your brain, to think, to move past. We go into stories sometimes that that's what we do specifically, just to see if we get pushback. So we are entering close to that 30-minute mark where there's just 30 minutes left in the show, so we'll take another break. After that, of course, the phone lines will still be open, but we'll go ahead and we will talk about outrage of the week, headlines you may have missed, and if there's time, we will hit another story. If nobody calls in, there probably will be some time. But if somebody would like to call and discuss any of these issues,
I'd be happy to have those discussions. Again, that number, if you would like to call, 347-426-3550, or you can give us a call toll-free if you need to at 888-287-5313. And just in case you needed to know, if you're watching the if you're listening to the show at Blog Talk, you can connect with us via Skype. If you have your own Skype account, you can hit the Skype button. See a little Skype button near the title of the show on the page that you're listening to now. So at any rate, you can do any one of those things to get in through, and I would love to have a comment or two on any of today's topics if you are so inclined. In the meanwhile, let's go ahead and take this last break of the day. And when we come back, we will head down the home stretch. Stay with me. We will be right back.
Well, I'm moving out west now. They say there's never clouds. So I'm sitting just wishing I could be.
Tap into the truth. Listen in live every Sunday at 3 p.m. Check us out at tapintothetruth.com for our latest blog posts and for links to all of our past broadcasts. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. That's Tap Into the Truth every Sunday at 3 p.m.
Thanks for staying with us. Wanted to go ahead and remind everybody that if you're looking for the podcast and don't necessarily want to take the time to pull up Blog Talk, which, of course, you can find the podcast of today's show there. It'll be archived immediately after the show concludes. You also can find the podcast at iTunes. You can find us at tunein.com, and you can find us at stitcher.com. You also can find Tap Into the Truth at Spreaker, where I do separate broadcast over there. We have elevated the podcasting there in a range between anywhere from an hour to 2.5 hours. Occasionally I will go as far as 3 hours with the show. Usually that's determined by topic content of the day, things that I wanted to get in, and you know the fact that sometimes I get started and just don't want to shut up. And the bottom line is I can do that. I'm paying for everything that's necessary to get the show going, and as long as people are listening, why not? And I do want to thank everyone who is listening over at Spreaker and the folks listening here, of course, too. Just mentioned specifically because I have had a sudden uptick here recently in the number of followers, so we're over 150 now, and the number of plays. As the number of plays continue to grow per episode, there's still that obvious core level of listenership, but we're getting the message out to more and more people. So thank you, everyone who participates, both in the chat rooms, both here and there, and who catches us on the podcast. I appreciate it. I always enjoy anybody that takes the time to be part of the show. I really appreciate it. But for the folks that take the time to listen, that means a lot too. I mean, it really does. That it makes any host feel better about the time that they put into a show, knowing that there are people that are listening to the show, that they are enjoying it enough, either by being challenged by it or by agreeing with the points or by just finding out new information maybe they had missed, whatever your reason for listening may be, it always makes a host feel better that they're reaching that audience. And right now, that's more important than ever. When you're talking about a conservative message or a libertarian message or just a common sense constitutional message, it's more important than ever that we be able to reach out and get new people hearing that message. Now, some people want to scream and shout and yell and bring it from a fiery pulpit style of message. And there's a place for that. But usually those folks are only going to end up preaching to the choir. Then there's the middle-of-the-road folks. I think I kind of fall into that category because, you know, I do get a little riled up on some topics, and sometimes I will be yelling into the microphone, and, you know, it's hard to keep the passions down. If you're paying attention, it's hard not to be angry. But I try to have legitimate conversations with people who are on both sides of the arguments. I make that effort because I'm trying to make the case for, as Sarah Marie Brenner says, conservatarianism. And to be a conservatarian means that basically you're walking the line between conservative and libertarian, which, you know, grasping onto traditional values, conservative monetary policies, fiscal policies, but to be libertarian and wanting people to be able to have freedom in their personal lives, to enjoy and to express their individual liberty. I think that's a very important message. And I think that is the kind of message that we try to get across here too. So this is how we do it. We have to bring the information, so we put out the opinion. You're not always going to agree with me. I'm not always going to agree with you. Some of you, we're never going to agree on almost anything. But if we can find that one place that we do agree on, that's a starting point. That is a place where we can start to build a relationship where maybe you find out I'm not so bad and I find out you're not so bad. And there is a place that we can start to work together towards rebuilding this country. Why does this country need to be rebuilt, you may wonder? Chances are, if you're listening to this show, then you probably already know the answer to that. We are under assault. These so-called progressives, not just people who think they're progressives, because that's what a lot of folks in the Democratic Party are calling themselves these days, but the actual people that are so-called progressive. I've explained this before. I'll do it again. The reason why I continue to refer to them as so-called progressives is because if you are a true progressive, then you are for progress. That's it. You want progress. You want improvement. You want things to go down the road and embrace new technologies and new ways of doing things and new ways to think. And there is nothing wrong with that. That is, in essence, a big part of the American spirit. But people calling themselves progressive, they want change, and they don't care what the repercussions of that change may be. In fact, they have a completely different agenda. They know what their end goal is. They call themselves progressive because that was a word that polled well. It was focus tested, and it did well in the test groups. They call themselves progressive because it sounds like that's somebody embracing the future. But their vision of the future is what's troubling. Their vision of the future is an America that doesn't have the Constitution as a guidepost for the government, that doesn't have the Constitution in place checking the power and the authority of the government, keeping our federal government in check, leaving the sovereign authority of being governed in the hands of the governed. That's what they want. That is not being progressive. That is being communist, socialist, Marxist, anti-constitutionalist. That's what those people are. But they hide behind that word. So I will, when I'm referring to the so-called progressives, I'm talking about eugenicists and anti-libertarians and politicians that want more power over you, claiming, of course, that it's for your own good. Now, there are a lot of useful idiots out there, people that are going right along with it, because they buy into part of the social programming. They think that it really is for the best. Those people, they're well-meaning enough. They have good intentions, but we all know what road is paved with good intentions. We have to keep an eye out for those folks. Beware the true so-called progressive. The rest of you, get educated. Understand. I mentioned Sarah Marie Brenner just a little while ago. Last week on her show, she spent 4 out of 5 days discussing how the roots of the current Democratic Party's social agenda are all rooted in communist and socialist ideologies. She went over it. She's trying to educate. And even though she didn't do any name-calling, she didn't call anybody out specifically, and I listened all week to the show. If you're not listening to Sarah Marie Brenner, by the way, you are missing out. You can find her on Heartland Radio at the moment. Or you can go to sarahmariebrenner.com and listen to her show. She's live from 3 to 4 o'clock weekdays, and then you can find the podcast usually up 30 minutes after the show's over, or you can go over to Spreaker.com and you can find the podcast there. But the point still being, it was a great show. She was very educational, and you can verify every last bit of what I'm telling you based on going and listening for yourself. Again, spend a little time to your own research. Use your brain. She didn't do any name-calling. She didn't call anybody out specifically. She just went over policy and where it was rooted from, how socialism ties in with labor unions, how socialism ties in with income equity, things of that nature. It was great, very informative. But she still got pushback, people that wanted to paint her as being hurtful intentionally, as attacking people. And that's not what happened in that. Some people just, most likely, just saw the title of the shows and commented rather than listening. People like that will never be reached. But it's important that we educate people. In the past, these type of agendas, this movement, the so-called progressive movement, would have never been tolerated. The policies that are being pushed would have never been tolerated in the United States because even the least educated among us recognized it instantly as being socialist or communist. We recognized it instantly, and we also recognized instantly that that's not what we do here in America. That's not what we do in the United States. Because income equity is not the same thing as income opportunity, and you cannot have both. Central planning demands income equity. That means anytime you do something to increase your income, they're going to take it from you and give it to somebody else that hasn't done anything to increase theirs. That's equity. That equity is far from equitable for the people putting in the work. Income opportunity is what America has been about. And that's what the so-called progressives are fighting against. And they utilize the poor and the undereducated to try and convince them that it's their right, that they're being held down by the masses that are above them. And for those of us who were educated enough to recognize that, we've seen that play out before. The Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, the Boxer Revolution in China. We have seen the undereducated convinced that those people of the higher society, the bourgeois class, were keeping down the lower class. And unfortunately, there's a growing number of people in the United States that are falling into that same trap of that manner of thinking. And for that, We've got to reach out to those folks before they get too far convinced that that's what they deserve. You don't deserve. Nobody owes you a living. But you have the opportunity to get education, to move forward, and to make a life for yourself. Everybody has opportunity. But it's up to you to take advantage of those opportunities. Simple. Here in Tennessee, we just had the State of the State address from Governor Bill Haslam. And one of the new things that he's introduced this legislative cycle is called Promise Tennessee. And the idea here is to get tuition for all in-state students to two-year community colleges paid for across the board. You meet certain academic standards. They're adjusting the HOPE scholarships as well that had been coming from lottery money. And they're building a foundation, and they'll be utilizing that to fund this, taking some of the money from the lottery and then looking to build up funds. And they want to keep this promise, though, that you'll be able to help students further attend four-year universities with higher tuition rates, but that you can start out and spend your first 2 years at a community college. And we have some great community colleges here in Tennessee. One right here, actually, I live just literally a few feet from, it's more than a few, but I live very close to a great, the home campus of Lone State Community College, right here in East Tennessee, down here at the Harriman campus. And the bottom line here is there's some great two-year schools with great educators and great programs. And now you have the opportunity coming straight out of high school, if they get this passed, and I have no reason to think that they won't under the circumstances, to start a college degree and not have any out-of-pocket expenses. Well, I mean, not to pay tuition at any rate. And that's a pretty big deal. So the point stands that even now with the HOPE scholarships, with federal grant monies that are available, Pell Grants and whatnot, you still have the opportunity already to take advantage of an education. There is no excuse for somebody not to get to go to college. None. But you don't have to go to college necessarily to take advantage of opportunities. But you have to be willing to do the work, put in the effort, and take advantage of those opportunities. That's on you. That's on me. That's on my daughters. That's on your children, your grandchildren. And it's up to us to do that. And it's up to us to instill the sense of pride and the sense of work in our friends, our neighbors, our children, so that they can take advantage of that. We've got to stop letting these people feel defeated and let them accept that they need the help from the government, because they don't. Government help is a trap. It's a trap. Okay, before I get too far down that, I could run out the rest of the show, unfortunately, on that topic. So here's what I'm going to do. We're going to go ahead and get to the outrage of the week. And I got to tell you, this week's outrage is something that was certainly of interest to me when I read it, because it was absolutely astounding that statements would be made like this. I mean, we've seen more and more of this similar type activity. We have people in Congress who are standing up and telling us that they are not relevant to the process. Why? Why are they not relevant to the process? They are the process. That's how legislation starts. That's how it's supposed to begin. But we have people in the House, Sheila Jackson Lee is where we're starting at right now, that have grouped together to form themselves a new little caucus, and they feel like it's their responsibility to try and get Americans back to full employment. Now, that's a lovely thought. It's a great idea. If the government was capable of doing that, wouldn't it already be done? I mean, the only way the government puts everyone back to full work is if they start opening up work camps, which, you know, it would not surprise me if that didn't come along at some point. But Sheila Jackson Lee made some fabulous statements about how they were going to put together executive orders. They were going to start drafting executive orders to give to Barack Obama. And the whole purpose of giving them these work orders, because obviously they can't get legislation through the House. She's a representative. She's saying that her branch of the government is no longer relevant, but that it should be their number one priority. That was a quote. To draft executive orders that Barack Obama can sign so that they can try and get Americans back to work. Now, that is just one of the outrages of the week. Unfortunately, this week, there's more than that. I wish that was all. It's hard to pick just one some weeks. That was the biggest one. That, to me, is the most outstanding, most outrageous statement that I had heard. It is unimaginable that a member of the House of Representatives, someone from Texas, no less, I mean, the Democrats in Texas are just as level as the Democrats anywhere else, I suppose. Everything's bigger in Texas. The conservatives are more conservative. The liberals are more liberal. They've created this new congressional caucus that they're calling the Congressional Full Employment Caucus. And she publicly said that they will be giving President Obama a number of executive orders that he can decide. That they'll be writing up these orders. And that writing these orders should be their number one agenda. What about, oh, I don't know, something as simple as writing legislation? That's what you do when you're in the House, Ms. Lee. You write legislation. You put it in front of the committee that's necessary to get it worked on and get it finalized, and then that legislation makes its way to the floor and you get it voted on. That should be your number one priority. Why is it not your number one priority? Sheila Jackson Lee is exactly what you would expect from a centralized congressional Democrat who does believe in socialism. It's just that plain and simple. That is completely outrageous, and I couldn't believe that any member of the House, as much as I couldn't believe any member of the Senate, would stand by a statement like that. But to make it publicly, for these people to stand up and say, oh, yes, our body of government, the legislative branch of our government, is no longer relevant. We should only exist now to draft executive orders. That's Sheila Jackson Lee is agreeing that Barack Obama should just take action. Ignore the law. Just give executive decree. I don't understand why people would vote for someone who would say that. It's beyond me. It goes outside of the pale of understanding. She is supposed to be there representing you, members of the Texas Congressional District that live in her district. I don't have the specific district in front of me at the moment, otherwise I would call you out specifically, but she's supposed to be there representing you. She is supposed to be your voice. She's supposed to stand up and speak on your behalf. And I'm assuming that when she gets on the floor of the House and has her opportunity to talk, which she does, it's usually good for a laugh for most conservatives, I'm assuming that she is representing you when she says that. And that's fine. You elected her, and if she's doing that job for you, then you're getting what you want. That's fine. And you shouldn't be silent. She should be there. But if she now thinks, if she believes that it should be the number one role, the number one priority of her little new caucus to draft executive orders instead of representing you and drafting legislation, then she no longer serves you, and you should find someone else who's willing to. The Constitution is not a dead, irrelevant document. The Constitution is designed to protect each individual here, regardless of your ideology, your political beliefs, your religious beliefs, skin tone. Regardless of all those things, it's meant to protect you from an abusive central government, or worse than that, a dictator. Sheila Lee Jackson just said that her job should now be to help the dictator be a dictator. She doesn't represent you anymore. She doesn't represent American values anymore. And I call on the people of her district to find someone else and vote for them. I don't care if it's another Democrat. I mean, naturally, I prefer a conservative who is a constitutionalist be selected. There's plenty of them in Texas, by the way. But you, at the very least, need to find another Democrat who's willing to stand up and represent you in the manner in which a representative is supposed to, not somebody who's willing to capitulate to a dictator. And that's what she just did. Okay, real quick, because we are running out of time, we're inside of the last 4 minutes of the show. One other issue that I wanted to touch on, it seems like there was an issue this past week with administrators at a school system in Colorado putting a ban on a patriotic celebration. Now, the Colorado school, which had rejected a request of its own student council to hold a Patriotic America Day, saying that it would offend non-American students, well, they decided that they wanted to change their mind. See, they did this despite the fact that they do have students that requested to participate in a Cinco de Mayo celebration, and the school said yes. In fact, students that are not of Mexican descent were required to participate in a Cinco de Mayo celebration. Well, a lot of folks were outraged at the actions of the administrator at Fort Collins High School, and they called and they emailed the school en masse. Angry local sheriff came out to protest at the very beginning, broad at the crack of dawn, very, very cold morning, I might add, snow on the ground. There's pictures online that you can find, waving American flags, protesting. Well, the protests worked. The principal reversed course, apologized, and even sent letters to parents announcing that they would, in fact, have America Day. Now, having turned down America Day after requiring students to participate in Cinco de Mayo is an outrage. But what's even more outrageous, the angry parents and the angry people in the county need to keep this in mind. The people that made that decision in the first place, they're still in charge. I don't know how many members of their student council, not student council, I'm sorry, I don't know how many members of their school board may be up for election right now, but you need to be looking into changing principals, changing school administrators, whoever your school, whether it's superintendent or what you call that position now, those people are still in charge. And they will do this again. You need to hold them accountable in a way that Americans do, through changes in positions and elected seats. Ladies and gentlemen, that's got to be it for today's show. I hope everyone enjoyed it. I hope that you had a great week and that this upcoming week will be even better. Again, quick reminders that we'll be on again next Sunday, and you can find us at Spreaker.com through the week if you want to check out live shows. But please remember, as always, don't take my word for it. Definitely don't take their word for it. always, take a little bit of time, do your own research, use your brain, and always be prepared to put in a little bit of effort if you really want to tap into the truth. Goodbye, everybody. Have a great week. See you next week.
Heartbreak, but it was-